Hi, it's Patrick here. And here's a question that many of us wonder about. Does the language we speak define us? Does the fact that I'm a native English speaker, does it frame how I view the world and how I respond to it? And when I speak a second or a third language, does that open doors that are closed to me, the English speaker? What happens to this guy, for example, when he switches back to his native German?
Und vor ein Jahr haben wir uns verlobt.
From the English he usually speaks these days.
My fellow Americans, this is an amazing moment for me. To think that a once scrawny boy from Austria could grow up to become governor of the state of California and then stand here.
Does the governator change when he speaks English? Does he think more creatively? Because, let's face it, English is so much more creative a language than German, right? Just kidding.
Hasta la vista, baby.
And nice to hear that again. That little piece of dialogue turned that phrase into English. Delivered, of course, with a Teutonic accent. So on today's pod, the question of language and identity and personality with writer Robert Lane Green. He's written a book about what we think language is and what it really is. Also, how we mess with language, how we try to improve it, make it politically correct or grammatically correct, and how we do all of that at our peril.
You can literally go back to Cicero, who said that, you know, Latin was being spoken disgracefully around him, that standards had dropped and that nobody knew the language properly anymore, so much so that he went into a kind of quiet, grumpy period late in life where he said he just didn't bother correcting people anymore.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. New words, old words, censoring everything.
This podcast, also the World Radio Program, The Big Show, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org. This podcast is at theworld.org/language. It's also at a couple of other places, patrickcox.wordpress.com. And on Facebook, just do a search for The World in Words. And I'm on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. So today, language and identity with Robert Lane Green. Green is a correspondent for The Economist, and he's written a book called You Are What You Speak. It's a great read, and it dovetails nicely with this podcast and with what y'all have told me in your posts and your emails that you're all interested in. So to warm things up, I just want to hear from one other person who is obsessed as anyone is on this subject of language and personality. Her name is Li Jiajiang. She's the author of a memoir called Socialism is Great! The book is written not in her native Chinese, but in English. And that's very important for Jiang. What she's about to say isn't especially original or unique, though I love the way she says it. But it is a great reminder that many, many people who speak more than one language have precisely this feeling. Here goes.
Learning language, I mean, the first Roman Empire famously said, when you learn a new language, you gain a new soul, you gain a new personality. I don't know if I haven't gained a new soul, but when I speak English, I just feel my personality changes slightly. For example, when I speak Chinese, I sound ruder, louder. And writing this book in English in some ways freed me. For example, the sex thing probably will be less detailed in Chinese. It's just because I don't think Chinese is particularly a language in describing feelings, emotions, and personal relationship. The very word, romantic, we didn't have that word in Chinese. That's translation, romantica. So I think in some ways writing English freed me. In my book, I give an example. I met a young man I rather fancied, and I said, in English, you look cool. Back then, that's just something a young woman would not say to a young man, but I said it. I could get away because I said it in English.
Chinese writer Li Jiajiang. So, does she take on a new personality when she speaks or writes English? Or does she just use English to uncover hidden aspects of what was already there in her personality? Or does the language use her in a way? Does it shape how she thinks by its constructions, the words it has to describe things, the words it doesn't have? Does language determine who she is? Well, These are among the questions that Robert Lane Greene considers in You Are What You Speak. And as soon as I heard about this book, I knew that I had to speak with the author. Here's our conversation. I'm studying Chinese right now, and just about my favorite question to ask of any new student who comes in is, why are you studying Chinese? Because there are about 1,000 right. different reasons for studying a language. Right. And it's right. like, you know, you get this potted biography of somebody in their answer. So mm-hmm. I have to ask you which languages you are either studying or have studied, and in each case, why?
I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, the suburbs of it, so not the most multilingual place in the world and not in a multilingual home or anything like that. But I started Spanish in high school at the worst possible time, which is age 14, when a student comes to a school, new high school, and the last thing in the world you want to do is start making funny sounds in front of the new kids you want to impress, the new girl you have a crush on, and so forth. But this totally failed to dissuade me. I loved Spanish right away. I found it easy. I did well in tests, but I just enjoyed it. It was like cracking a code, and it just tickled my brain in some way that I found just delightful. So I did 4 years of Spanish, twice as much as you're required to do in high school. And then I got to college, and I started German because I wanted to do something new. And I did 2 years of German, which was enough to get me into my third year of college at the University of Hamburg in Germany. So I did all my coursework in German, writing and reading and so forth over there. I also took Portuguese for Spanish speakers at college because there was an accelerated class for people who already knew Spanish grammar, which made it easier to learn Portuguese. I did a year of French. I did a year of Russian and got those worked up pretty well. And then since formal education, I started Arabic in about 2002. I met a wonderful, beautiful Danish woman in 2005 who's now my wife, and so I've learned Danish. And with all the other Romance languages in pocket, I figured I could learn Italian pretty quickly, which I've set about to do. So that's the answer to those questions.
And okay, so why do you keep learning more ones? I mean, that's a ton of languages. Italian, for example, right at the end there.
Well, Italian was pretty easy to add on. If I decided to, say, try Chinese now or ancient Greek or something, I'd have to really set aside some time and some sort of mental resources. I'm running into my mental limits on keeping them all as fresh and as fluent as I'd like them to be. I'd rather know 5 or 8 well than 13 or 14 haltingly. So I'm close to making the decision, painful though it is, that I have limits in terms of time and in terms of brain power. And so I'm going to try to keep maintaining, keep expanding my vocabulary, my reach, and my range in the really hard ones, primarily Arabic and Russian, which are harder than all the others, which are a little closer to English.
Well, when I started this podcast about 3 years ago, I believe, like I think a lot of people who speak more than one language, that I thought in a different way in, you know, other languages. And you know, some people say they behave differently, their personality changes when they speak in a second language. Is that something that has ever occurred to you? And what have you since concluded about it?
I think that there's something to that. But it's not necessarily what I think a lot of people think there is to it. I think that a lot of people think that when they speak German, they are forced to construct sentences in a certain way and conclude that that way is highly logical. Because, for example, you have to remember what verb you're using in a subordinate clause. If it's a certain kind of verb, then it goes all the way at the end. And it makes you work hard in a certain way. And then beyond that, the Germans have a reputation of being logical, technological, orderly, and so forth. I think that what's actually going on when people say that German makes them think this way and feel this way is that they're kind of inhabiting Germanness in their mind. They're identifying with Germans and German culture and what they associate with German in their own minds and their own preconceptions. And so I'm sure they probably really do feel more German and really do feel more logical. But what I would resist in terms of interpreting this is that German is a logical language and sort of forces logical thought in a way that, say, Spanish doesn't. If I said Spanish to someone, they would think passionate. They would think fiery. They would think romantic. They would think of Spain or Latin America and very different cultural associations that we have with Spanish. And so I hear people saying, oh, I feel more expressive or something like that. And I don't think that has to do with the vocabulary or the grammar of Spanish. I think it has to do with the mental process by which when speaking a foreign language, and especially if you do it well, you really kind of inhabit the whole culture. You try to take on some of the assumptions. The vocabulary is very evocative. There are words that maybe have connotations in Spanish that don't have the same connotations when you translate the word literally into English. And so I do think there's a certain process of inhabiting another psychology, but I don't think that it's the technical properties of the language. If you think about it, Spanish has a very complicated verb conjugation system. It's highly ordered, it's highly structured, it's highly logical, and yet we don't apply – most people wouldn't say, oh, I speak Spanish and I feel so logical. I think it's because we don't have that sort of cultural attachment to Spanishness. We might have it with Germanness, and people say, oh, maybe in French they feel more expressive or romantic.
And after all, I mean, in Germany, people do declare their love for each other. They have relationships. They don't flip to Spanish or French to do that. They live life somewhat like everybody else does.
Yeah.
Now, in previous podcasts, we've taken a look at some of the research about how, for example, a noun's gender can affect how we use that noun. I think the example was the word for bridge in German and Spanish, which use different genders, and how, therefore, we attach different adjectives to it, and the idea being that we think of those, you know, that thing, the bridge, in a very different way. And we've also talked about that language in Australia, whose name I cannot pronounce, Cook. Thayor, is that how you say it?
Yeah, that's as good as I can do.
That uses very specific cardinal directions, like there's an ant on your southwest leg. We clearly don't go there. Both of those pieces of research do suggest that to a certain degree that this, as the linguists say, this Whorfian view of language has has some currency.
There has been a swinging of the pendulum. It's swung towards Whorfianism very heavily in the early part of the century around Whorf's own time and carried through a lot of the middle of the century. Then sort of psycholinguistics started going back the other way, and the sort of Steven Pinker view and Noam Chomsky view that all languages were fundamentally identical, and now it's swinging back gradually again. The work you're thinking of, I'm sure, is that of Lyra Boroditsky, who did some of the work with the Cook Dayor in Australia, and some of the research on gender identification with nouns was put into Guy Deutscher's book Through the Language Glass, which is great, and I recommend both of their writings to absolutely everyone, because it's a great entree into the topic, and both are brilliant people who are not going to feed you a load of bull. But one of the answers to that Whorfian claim is to say, well, you know, a bridge doesn't really have gender. So when asked a sort of arbitrary question like what personal characteristics do you associate with a bridge, it maybe is no wonder that people start thinking, well, I don't really know how to answer that question, but it is, you know, el puente in Spanish, which is masculine. And so I guess it should be considered sturdy and strong and powerful. And if you ask a German speaker, they'll say, well, it is die Brücke, so it's feminine. I guess it's graceful. It's beautiful. So you're really asking people a question that doesn't have a right answer. And so they're using a sort of secondary layer of association to sort of give some kind of answer. It's not surprising that it happens. It's certainly interesting. But I don't think this particular example supports really heavy Whorfian claims that, you know, the language you speak so strongly influences your thinking that you're really a different person speaking Spanish. For the Cook Theor example, that is totally fascinating. I mean, this is a small group, but there are other groups, one in Mexico, that have this same cardinal direction thing where they never refer to left and right, only east and west and north and south. We have to do some more research on this to find out just how different the cognition is. But I think Lila Gleitman, another psycholinguist, points out that there's another island where the millions of inhabitants stay constantly oriented. And I'm sitting in it right now. It's called Manhattan. And pretty much anywhere on the street that you are, you know which way is uptown and which way is downtown. So we can read a little too much into this. The data is fascinating. But before kind of jumping to conclusions, as exciting as they may sometimes be, I really encourage people to read the research and to go to the papers. They're not terribly technical, and they are really interesting.
Right. I mean, I remember just thinking about that when I first read about it. It's just, well, maybe this is also a group of people who spend most of their time outside. And
yeah,
so,
that's right.
You know, the sun, the stars, the moon. I mean, there's a lot of indicators that we inside people just don't have.
Right. That's true. The group I mentioned in Mexico, they orient towards a local landmark, which is a large mountain or volcano. So it doesn't work when you take them away from that. They do stay oriented even when they're inside, even when you spin them around and so forth. But if you fly them across the country, the ability disappears. And that's also true of the Cook Dayor there in Australia. If you fly them to Sydney, they are lost. So you make a good point about them. That being said, there are neighboring groups right next to these peoples who live in the same physical environment but whose language doesn't encode cardinal directions all the time this way, and they don't have the ability that their neighboring groups do. So the language clearly does play a role in that regard.
Oh, that's very interesting. So the Mexican group, do they say, I'm west of the volcano, north of the – I mean, how do they how do they refer to it?
Instead of east and west, north and south, it'd sort of be a volcano side, away from the volcano, perpendicular volcano towards the river, and perpendicular to the volcano, away from the river, something like that. But everything is sort of relative to the volcano. But then again, I lived in New Orleans for college, and we said lakeside and riverside because north of the city is Lake Pontchartrain, and south of it is the Mississippi River. So if you said which side of the street is it on, people would say lakeside or riverside because the streets all curve in a crescent shape, so you can't always say north, south. East, west, because most people might not even know. They do know lakeside and riverside. So again, it's not to say those are exact equivalents, but it is to say geographical landmarking and staying aware in that sense is not limited to these exotic groups. Manhattanites do it and New Orleanians do it as well.
But of course, everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people probably think that their language does it best. And this comes on to another major point that you look at in the book, which is that so many people in the world think that their language is special, that there's some uniqueness about their own language that sort of raises it above all other languages. My language is special. English is a special language because it's the open source language that allows everything. French is special because you can express certain very specific things in French that makes it good for diplomacy, what have you. Mm-hmm. But your view is that that's overplayed.
Even as recently as a couple of years ago, the French proposed making French the only legal language of the European Union, that it be the sort of underlying language. And I think it was a former head of the French Academy who said that the French language just had a logical rigor to it that made it just to him it was just natural and clear as day that it had a rigor to it that English and German and much less maybe sort of Portuguese and Romanian and Finnish had. And so I don't think that French is logical in a way that Finnish is not. I'd be very surprised if someone could show me that in a psycholinguistics laboratory. But beliefs like that are extremely common. In the book, I look at Bill Bryson. I start with a sort of light example. He wrote a great fun book called The Mother Tongue about English. Great book. It's read by many people. In fact, in telling people I was writing a language book, people said, you must read The Mother Tongue. I said, as a matter of fact, I have read it. And I start off with a few criticisms of it because among other things, Bryson passes along a lot of stories about other languages that don't pass the sniff test, and I go into those in the introduction to my own book. But then he starts it with English, and he says English has amazing abilities, like the ability to extract double duty from a word as both a noun and a verb, fire, sleep, run. And the one reply to that is vast numbers of languages do exactly that same thing, where a word can be a noun or a verb. Verbs are made from nouns. Nouns are made from verbs. And in some cases, I think Chinese might be one, it can be hard to tell exactly what role noun or verb lots of words are playing. It depends on syntax and context.
Tell me about it.
But to Bryson, this is an amazing feature of English. It's not amazing to any language because it's extremely common around the world. He goes on to say, modern English suffers a unique plague of being watered down by academic waffle and bureaucratic jargon. Well, believe me, you can catch the exact same phenomenon in other languages, in European languages that I'm familiar with. So a lot of the things that we think are unique to our language are more common than that.
Is there, though, a case to be made that English has become dominant in part, of course, because of history and politics, but also in part because it does have this sort of open source quality to it, where it's not thrown by, the onslaught of other languages, by a lot of people speaking it as a second or a third language who are likely to mix in some of their native languages into the mix, that English can just take this on?
I think that there may be something to that. I again, somewhat resist the argument. I think this is the globish argument that English's innate properties made it a global language. I think that's much more to do with the rise of the British Empire and the rise of the American superpower than it does with, say, English's relative lack of verb inflection or the relative lack of declension. I think that that being said, it is a twice conquered language in the sense that you had Anglo-Saxon conquered first by Vikings speaking a different Germanic language and then by the Norman French, and then they took on a lot of words from the Latin of the church, and then Britain went around and conquered half the world, and we took on words from Arabic and Hindi and other languages, and then America did the same with the American West. So it is a rich language. I think there's no doubt. I try to say that most of language myths should be investigated pretty carefully, but I think English has a greater variety of sources than probably any other language in the world, maybe definitely so. But is that part of the secret of its success? Maybe. It may be that when English speakers come in contact with another group and they show a willingness to adopt some of the other group's words, English is perceived as slightly less foreign because the colonists or the invaders or the cowboys or whoever they are showing this, you know, this flexibility and this interest in the other culture by borrowing some words. But I don't think it's the properties of English that are the primary reason for English's success. I think that we see that by the fact that French was the dominant language of Europe for hundreds of years, and that was not because of the logical properties of French. It was because of the armies of the Sun King and Napoleon, I think.
Right, right, right. Well, whether or not English is this free-for-all type of a language, there are certainly plenty of people who make a lot of money and spend a lot of time trying to fix the language, and you reserve a little place in your book for Lynn Truss, who's the latest of a long line of these people, and probably rather rich of late as a result of her book Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. You note that your book will not sell in the volumes that hers has. And it does seem to be something that we, whether we're English speakers or any other speakers for that matter, love to just... We can't walk away from it. If there's a good, right, you know, grammar argument to be had, we'll have it. But your sense of these arguments is that we should, what, consider the language in its historical context.
Yeah, I think that, well, I mean, I've shown that, and other people have shown that. I call it sort of declinism. I mean, we call it sticklerism when I'm talking specifically about language. But sticklerism, I think, is a subset of a broader phenomenon called declinism, which is the sort of belief that a lot of people are quite attached to, that there was a golden age not that long ago, but we're losing it or we've lost it, and we must try very hard to get it back. That change is generally bad, and it very often seems to kind of correspond with the writer or the speaker's childhood or younger days, you know, the 50s and just before the sexual and cultural and all these other revolutions happened that changed the world as we know it very quickly. But you can literally go back. I've gone back in the book to Cicero, who said that, you know, Latin was being spoken disgracefully around him, that standards had dropped and that nobody knew the language properly anymore, so much so that he went into a kind of quiet, grumpy period late in life where he said he just kind of didn't bother correcting people anymore. And to a certain extent, he was right. Latin was declining. What was happening was it was turning into early French and early Italian and early Spanish and Portuguese. It was changing. I think the logical break is that people value the language. And so when it changes, they say a good thing is changing. It must be getting worse. But sometimes change isn't from good to bad. Sometimes change is from good to good or from good to better or just a neutral change. It doesn't really make something overall better and worse. The point I make in the book is people are very attached to language. It's something they're very passionate about, and I'm passionate about it too. But if they're passionate about it, then change is hard too. They love something, and then they see the kids not using words that they used when they were growing up. And meanwhile, they're manufacturing this new slang, and they seem like they can't even be bothered to say a whole phrase. They say WTF, and they say OMG, and you know, it seems like laziness. It seems like corruption. It seems like breakdown. They don't see that there's also an enrichment going on, that there's new words being added, that there are new features being added to the language. And so it's just because we love language, it's too easy to conclude that change is bad. But change is not usually bad. There's never been a language that's declined into grunting and growling. It's never happened in the history of any language.
I take your point, and there's no one who loves a new word more than I do. And I think it's wonderful that, especially with English right now, it seems as though we just have a ton of new words. And that's wonderful. But you can't say that, for example, just an apostrophe misplaced, misused, is something that we should pass off as a creative new use of the language.
No, I think in particular written language has conventions that they're conventions because everyone educated in the conventions uses them. So almost by definition, they're right, and to break them is to do wrong. So if you put an apostrophe on your sign that says tomatoes for sale in the word tomatoes, you've made a mistake. I'm not one of those people who says everything is right, but I don't think that there's a serious descriptive linguist who thinks that everything is right. They would say that's a mistake in the mechanics of standard English. So not every individual change or individual expression is a good thing or is neutral. There are words that I think have good specific meanings, and I don't like seeing them used where I feel like that useful meaning is lost. Literally, it's one of my examples. People use literally all the time to say things like, you know, she literally had her head in the clouds, or they were literally had a gun to their head, when that's not at all what they mean. They mean figuratively. Literally is a great word, because if you're standing on two stools trying to change a light bulb and you fall, you can say, yeah, I literally fell between two stools. I mean, that's a great story. You get to break out literally in a literal sense. So to the extent that it loses that function, I think it's a loss of something. You know, I was out with friends last night, and we all exchanged our favorite peeves, a couple of teachers, a couple of writers. So I'm certainly not immune to thinking that there is incompetent use of language out there. There's plenty of it.
Right, right. I ran a BBC piece on a podcast a while ago from there's a stickler in Britain called Simon Heffer. I don't know if you've come across him.
I understand he's just published a book, right?
That's right. Yes. Right, yeah. And he's a columnist for the Daily Telegraph, which is a right-of-center newspaper. He's actually quite funny. He pokes fun at himself. But he cannot walk away. So when he sees signs, he just can't walk away. So on his way to work every day, he goes to his station and he sees a little sign for sandwiches, Italian sandwiches. And it says paninis. He has pointed out to the people.
Panini
is already plural. Yeah.
Right.
And he just he thinks about it every day.
If you walk in and order a panino, it's a panino, I think, is a singular. If you walk in and order a panino, most people will look at you like you're a little bit crazy. And then in the word tamales, if you know your Mexican food, tamales is plural. And so a lot of Americans have reconstructed the singular as tamale, but it's tamal in Spanish, and so tamales becomes the plural. English speakers sort of use their pluralization rule in reverse, strip off just the S, not the E, and so think that the singular thing is called a tamale, which would confuse a lot of Mexicans.
There you go. Right. You could have that with a chorizo sausage.
That's right.
Yeah. Let me ask you about accents as well, because I think that this is another thing where people get very upset. And again, it seems to me it's to do with some kind of identity politics. Mm-hmm. I remember doing a story when I had a stronger British accent, and I used the word, I'll just spell it for you, P-O-L-I-C-E, and I pronounced it police. And I got a note from, I'm guessing it was an older man, a listener. The note came in the form of a postcard, and it said, in this country, the word police has two syllables. Please adjust.
No. Yeah. Okay. He proved by writing you a postcard he did understand what you were saying. I guess I end the book by really pleading for an attitude of more enjoyment of language. If you walk around looking for things that you hate all the time, you can find them, sure. And that attitude, it gives certain people a certain kind of comfort. There must be some kind of sort of joy taken in it, because Lynn Truss's book, which I describe very sort of angry in tone, she talks about hacking people to pieces and lightning striking them dead and such. It sold millions of copies. So there are obviously millions of people out there who love this idea that you shouldn't just correct people or use good English yourself. You should get furious and send postcards saying, please adjust. You know, that doesn't make me feel good about myself. I'm a curious person. I'm a reporter by profession. I just like to walk around seeing new things and going, wow, I never knew that. Or it was a very strange way to say that. I've never heard that pronunciation. I believe in rules. Like I said before, English has standard rules. Written English especially, spoken English very much so anyway. But it also has variation. Language variation is a fact of every language in the world throughout every period of human history. There has never been a language that doesn't vary. So the whole field of sociolinguistics is, how does it vary and why? How does it vary by type of conversation that we're having, a formal interview or an informal chat? How does it vary by social class? How does it vary by region, by country, by state of mind, by, you know, whether you've had a few drinks, whatever it is? So I just like to ask and answer these questions because I think they're fascinating. My approach to language isn't sort of that of the referee or the judge handing out fines or traffic tickets. And I just say that the word police has two syllables in the South where I come from, but a lot of people would say it police. It's one of those words that takes a stress on the first syllable down in the South, like guitar and insurance and police and Coca-Cola. And that's not wrong either. That's just how it's said down South.
Coca-Cola? I never heard that one. I haven't paid attention.
That's a little country. You won't hear Coca-Cola as often, but you will hear police. You will hear guitar. You will hear insurance. I'm inhabiting my dad for a second here, who grew up in Macon, Georgia, and had a very, very Southern accent. And so, it's sort of a second dialect for me. I can dust off when I need it.
Just a couple of other little things on other languages. Firstly, you take a look at sort of the fixes that have taken place in certain other countries. You focus on several languages, including both Turkish and French. Turkish, it seems to me, has succeeded in a certain way insofar as they made a decision about the alphabet and mm-hmm. it became a crime in certain right. circumstances to use the other alphabet. It still is a crime. We've done stories on the crime of using certain letters in right, the Latin right. alphabet because they're associated right. with the Kurdish language. But it's very draconian. It seems to be about as draconian as there is an example right now. The French have got a somewhat different take. They have an academy that seems to be largely ineffectual, but is supported by the population, even if they ignore what the academy has to say.
Yeah.
I wonder if either of those tells you anything about how language fixes can sometimes work and may be a good idea.
Right. Well, I think that those two examples are pretty good bookends for the spectrum of possibility. Turkey under Ataturk in the 20s, 30s was a recently independent former empire, now reduced to an overwhelmingly Turkish, ethnically Turkish country, defeated in war, angry, humiliated. The old order was swept away. A new secular order arose. The caliphate and the sultanate were abolished. And all of a sudden you had a secular president who dressed in Western dress and spoke French and German and wanted very much to make Turkey a secular, Turkish, ethnically Turkish, Western-looking republic. And so we had all of these factors that were perfect, in combination. Ataturk and the party that he led were essentially, it was a one-party state led by a charismatic, powerful, and in fact beloved figure, so that you had as close to a blank slate as you're ever going to get with the language. He had that blank slate and he went with it. And in doing so, he banished the Arabic alphabet, started writing Turkish in the Latin alphabet, but maybe even more significantly, because an alphabet is relatively technical, sought also to strip all these words and vestiges of grammar from Arabic and from Persian out of Turkish. And that effort really is, though less visible, was more kind of consequential for Ottoman Turkish. The language that had been written for the Ottoman state included loads and loads of loan words from Arabic and Persian, and they were banned, and committees were set up to replace them with local native Turkish roots or words from Turkish roots. And as a result, between the alphabet change and the vast changes in the vocabulary, and given a couple of decades with these new rules enforced by the power of the state, very much so, it became a new Turkish. So much so that people educated after mid-century cannot easily read works that were just 50 or 100 years old. Imagine not being able to read works as recent as Faulkner or Henry James or Charles Dickens, because the language is so distant it's like Chaucerian English to you. That's a rough analogy to what Ataturk did with Turkish. Now, French is at the other end of that spectrum. It's a democracy that doesn't, by and large, use the heavy hand of the state to force people to use correct grammar, to forbid people from using English words. The French ministry can enforce the rules within government, so they can say you must not use l'email, you must use le courriel, but the people are going to say le mail for email, and nobody's fined on the street for using English. So in a democracy where pluralism is a value that most people accept, it becomes extremely hard. And I also tell the story of a very modest German spelling reform that became this huge catastrophe. People resisted it just incredibly. Several newspapers refused to use it, and it was sort of some states had a referendum against it. I mean, this is very – I mean, from the outsider – I was in Germany at the time. From the outsider, it seemed pretty modest and fairly logical, but people's attachment to the old spelling was such that it just was a mess. And if Germans can't tinker with their spelling without a mess, you can really say that big fixes in the language, like what Ataturk did with Turkish, really require a very heavy hand. I think you almost requires a dictatorship.
Well, on the subject of dictatorships and democracies, Arabic comes up as a language that's spoken in an area that's in considerable flux right now, but also as one that may be in need of a fix itself. Correct me if I'm wrong in this, whether I've got this right, but is there a problem with schooling in certain Arabic countries? Because it may be that the Arabic script that you're learning from is so, so different from the Arabic that you learn at home, that you grow up speaking, that you're alienated from the act of learning.
Yeah, well, the way you just described it is accurate, except that it's true of everywhere in the Arab world. We call it modern standard Arabic. It's a bit of a construct, but the Arabs call it Fusha. The modern standard Arabic that's spoken in formal political speeches, on television, in the mosques, and any formal occasion is not anybody's native language. It's a very strange state of affairs, but nobody speaks that language from the cradle. Parents don't speak that way to their children so that the children grow up speaking only that. It's just not true anywhere in the Arab world. What we have is modern dialects which differ quite strongly from place to place, so much so that it can be very hard to impossible for Arabs from two different regions to understand each other if they're both speaking their native dialects. So we have this weird situation, they call it diglossia in linguistics, meaning two tongues, where there's a sort of high version, the modern standard, and there's the low version, which is the different dialects around the regions. And so when a child gets to school, he's told it's time to learn Arabic. And, you know, if you thought about it at age six, you might say, but I thought I already spoke Arabic. But you learn that, no, what you speak is a sort of a corrupted, not real Arabic. It's time to sit down and learn the real language. And the real language is based on the Quran and based on the writings of the 7th century. And that's 1,300 years ago, if you're counting. So you're told that you don't really speak the real language and you need to learn it. It sort of does alienate people from the written word, and different scholars of education in the Arabic world have sort of raised a yellow flag about this, because it suddenly seems like written culture is not for you. Essentially all reading and writing, or nearly all, is done in a foreign language or a dialect that's so foreign as to effectively be a foreign language. Not exclusively. There are playwrights who write in, for example, a modern Egyptian colloquial Arabic. And, you know, a drama, a play in which people spoke in the modern standard would be very weird. So there is literary work in the dialect, and various literary figures do play with it. But by and large, all nonfiction and serious kind of writing is done in this language. It's not anybody's native language. It's a strange state of affairs. And so it's on Arabs' minds. It's on the agenda. It's on the radar. There are various plans to try to think of how we might approximate the dialects to one another and find their common features with the modern standard and create a new so-called Middle Arabic that would have the feature, you know, most of the features of the written standard, but the other features of the dialects that were common to as many dialects as possible. People talk about this, and it's been talked about for a long time. But since there's so many different Arab countries, it's never actually come to pass, because there's nobody who has the standing to really lead it forward.
I just wonder what the effect of Al Jazeera and the other sort of new pan-Arab media may be having on the Arabic language.
Well, that's a good question. I do watch a bit of Al Jazeera. It's, you know, goes in running speed. It's a little difficult for me, so I can't speak to, you know, is it affecting the way people speak Arabic? But with the profusion of satellite and the presence of the modern standard in every home, there are probably more people than ever exposed to the standard on a daily basis. And so everyone who does have that exposure will be able to kind of approximate formal Al Jazeera style Arabic and thus be able to kind of have a conversation. But it's still kind of a weird out-of-body experience where a Lebanese and a Moroccan would both have to essentially speak a third language called Arabic modern standard version to get along. But it can be done. And I imagine the pan-Arab media, especially television, is going to aid that process.
Robert Lane Green. His new book is called You Are What You Speak. I'll post links to that, also to the homepage of Chinese writer Li Jiajiang. They'll be at patrickcox.wordpress.com, also at theworld.org/language. You can post your comments there, or on the World in Words Facebook page, or you can tweet me. See you next week.